organizations typically start out with very poor governance and policies. They are highly fluid. Change is easy. However, the range of post-conflict outcomes is extremely wide. Some countries grow rapidly and maintain peace, while others fall apart again. This range of outcomes is far wider than the normal diversity of country experience. The very diversity suggests that some standards might be useful. If we could bring the worst up closer to the present best, it would make an enormous difference. Standards do not need to be abstract, but can draw upon the experience of what has worked well. A post-conflict charter should include guidance on behavior by donors and the international security regime. Donors should be committed for the decade, not just the first couple of high glamour years. International security forces should likewise be committed for the long haul. In return, post-conflict governments should reduce their own military spending. As we have seen, it is dysfunctional. They should have a transparent budgetary process so that public power does not translate into private profit. They should include opposition groups in power, for example through decentralization. And they should sort out conflicting and confused property claims quickly. These essential steps could be set out in an international charter. The international community has a very strong interest that post-conflict situations should go right, and it puts huge resources into them. Post-conflict governments are typically highly reliant upon others, and it is entirely reasonable that they should be, in effect, on probation for that first decade, placed under a set of rules that define the minimum acceptable progress before untrammeled sovereignty can be achieved. A charter for post-conflict situations could also usefully draw on the successful experiences of truth and reconciliation commissions. Perhaps the most highly visible one is South Africa's, but there have been others. Neither a vindictive pursuit of victors' justice nor a blanket of forgetfulness is desirable. An international norm would provide a much-needed sense of impartiality, typically lacking when procedures are drawn up ad hoc by whoever holds power in each particular situation. Some post-conflict processes have managed a swift drawing of lines that prosecutes some of the major offenders on both sides and gets as much as possible of the rest into the public record. One aspect of post-conflict policy is noticeable by its absence from the above suggestions, that relating to elections. At present, post-conflict political evolution is often dominated by elections, which are often imagined to be the key to re-establishing peace. If that is indeed the case, then elections should be a part of the post-conflict charter. But are they in fact so important? The team working on this included Anke Hoefler, Mans Soderbaum, and myself. Somewhat laboriously, we built a data set on all post-conflict experiences, more than 60 of them. We then looked to see what effect elections had on the risk of the reversion to conflict. This work is new, so it has yet to be properly peer-reviewed. The issue is contentious. In the world of post-conflict studies, there are two camps: those who think elections make things better, and those who think they make them worse. Each camp can point to particular elections for which their thesis looks plausible, but they cannot both be right. They can, however, both be wrong. As far as we can see, they are. Elections during the post-conflict decade seem to shift the risk. In the year before an election, the risk of renewed conflict goes sharply down, perhaps because the various groups direct their energies to the electoral contest. In the year after an election, the risk goes equally sharply up. Presumably, whoever has lost the election does not like the result and is inclined to explore other options. So elections may be desirable for all sorts of reasons, but they do not seem to make the society safer. Perhaps as solutions, they have been a little overplayed. A charter for investment. The bottom billion need private capital. Even though the world is awash with capital, the poorest countries are failing to attract it and are instead hemorrhaging their own. Remember that a key problem is the lack of reform credibility. Credibility looms large because investment runs up against the time consistency problem that we have repeatedly encountered. Once made, investment is far more difficult and costly to reverse than our policies. And so investors are wary of falling for a policy that looks attractive but is not maintained. The only option that is currently open to individual governments that are committed to reform is the costly and dangerous strategy of revealing their true type by going too far too fast. Can an international charter do better? What would an investment charter do? It would set out some simple rules to which a government would commit itself in its treatment of investors. Many governments already do this through national charters, but these charters lack credibility for precisely the reasons that there is a problem in the first place. The rules should apply to domestic investors as well as foreign investors, otherwise capital flight would be accentuated. Essentially, a charter would preclude governments from strategies of confiscation. A government set on confiscation, in fact, has many options open to it. It does not literally have to confiscate the assets. It can manipulate taxes, the exchange rate, and the prices that public utilities charge. That is, it can use policy instruments that all governments use, but push them into a range that is meant to be ruinous for a given company or industry. This is inevitably a matter of judgment, and so the essence of an effective charter is that there has to be some system of adjudication. Governments, of course, have their own judicial system, but it is hardly reassuring for investors if their only defense is through the courts of the government that has confiscated their investment. There are two complementary solutions, international arbitration and investor insurance. International arbitration is not an affront to sovereignty. It is simply a recognition that a government may find it very useful to put itself in a position where it has to argue its case before a neutral body rather than be free to ignore its own commitments. The governments that would find such a facility most useful are those that have severe problems of reputation and are trying to live them down. Arbitration has its limits, because even if the arbitrator finds in favor of an expropriated company, the government may choose to ignore the decision. That is where insurance comes in. Those rich country governments with companies that have substantial investments abroad long ago established insurance protection for them. In the United States, the organization is called the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPIC, and in the United Kingdom it is the Exports Credits Guarantee Department, ECGD. Obviously, they only provide insurance coverage for their country's own companies. Eventually, the board of the World Bank established an insurance company that could cater more globally. It is called the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, MIGA. If a firm that has taken out insurance with MIGA is expropriated, then MIGA pays up. It tries to recover the money from the offending government, which often takes years, but the company does not have to worry. Since the bottom billion countries need private investment, and this requires addressing the problem of investor risk, it was entirely appropriate for a global public development agency such as the World Bank to provide this service. MIGA, however, has one grave shortcoming. MIGA covers only foreign investment, and this creates two major problems. Domestic investors are important. Behind them lies all the capital that has left the country, in part because of risk, and needs to be attracted back into the country. And by covering only foreign investors, MIGA breaches the level playing field that governments are routinely urged to create for investors. Indeed, if you think about it, it is self-evidently preposterous that a global public institution should be favoring foreign investors over the citizens of low-income countries. The recent Commission for Africa proposed that MIGA should be opened up. The world nearly got a charter on investment. In the late 1990s, the OECD proposed a multilateral agreement on investment. The OECD probably was not the ideal institution to promulgate such a charter, because it does not have developing country representation, and so can easily be portrayed as merely serving the interests of rich countries. However, given the extreme shortage of agencies in a position to overcome the free rider problem associated with such a charter, the OECD was decidedly better than nothing. But that is what we have ended up with. The OECD was opposed by two groups. One was the governments of the bottom billion that are run by crooks and populists, leaders as notorious as Idi Amin, Mobutu Sese Seko, and Robert Mugabe, have depended upon not being differentiated from those who are genuinely trying to develop their countries. The whole point of an investment charter is for newly reforming governments to be able to signal their separation from this nefarious crew more cheaply than through the signaling strategies that are presently available. While this source of opposition was inevitable, yet could have been faced down, the other source was not inevitable, but proved decisive. The development NGOs lobbied against the multilateral agreement on investment in much the same way that, as you are about to see, the British charity Christian Aid has more recently lobbied against African trade liberalization. This was because the NGOs misread what the charter was about. They saw it as rich countries ganging up on poor countries to protect their capital investments, and did not acknowledge the reality that in the bottom billion there was no capital to protect because the risks had frightened investors off. An investment charter, and indeed the World Trade Organization, or WTO, can provide the governments of the bottom billion with a means of locking themselves into the commitments that they choose to make. In the language of economics, the general concept is termed commitment technologies. For the bottom billion, these technologies are chronically lacking, and the resulting credibility problem is debilitating for private investment. Without radically higher private investment, the reforming countries will not be able to reach middle-income status, but will linger in limbo and risk falling back into one of the traps. By posing the problem as that of a grasping rich world imposing its rules on a weak poor world, the NGOs conjured up a satisfyingly simple moral struggle in which they could campaign. But it was a fantasy world that, sad to say, did a disservice to the very people the NGOs are passionately trying to help. It was the headless heart in action. Changing our laws, promulgating international charters, global public goods. Changing our laws and promulgating international charters are global public goods. This is a grandiose way of saying that providing them is going to be problematic. Global public goods are grossly undersupplied because nobody has much interest in providing them. Being good for everybody, they face the ultimate free rider problem. The real problem, therefore, is not that of not knowing what to do, but getting around to doing it. I will return to that problem in Part 5. Chapter 10. Trade Policy for Reversing Marginalization. Generally, I do not much care for rich country wallowing in guilt over development. I find it contrived, and it diverts attention from a practical agenda. Citizens of the rich world are not to blame for most of the problems of the bottom billion. Poverty is simply the default option when economies malfunction. However, I am now going to pin some blame on citizens of the rich world, who must take responsibility for their own ignorance about trade policy and for its consequences. You personally may be well informed about trade, but if so, you are in a minority. In general, rich country electorates are deeply misinformed. Here is an example of the consequences. In fall 2004, Christian Aid, about the most trusted of the British charities, started a huge and expensive advocacy campaign about trade policy for the countries at the bottom. Under the slogan, "Free trade, some people love it," a capitalist, literally depicted as a pig, sat on top of an African peasant woman. That a Christian charity should be peddling the crudest images of Marxism may strike you as a little strange, and is an interesting line of inquiry, but this ideological cross-dressing is not my point. The key thing is that this message was grotesquely wrong. Trade policy is the area of economics least well understood by the NGO world. In the fall of 2005, Christian Aid stepped up its advertising campaign. Trade advocacy, it said, was its biggest issue. It claimed that Africa's rather modest reductions in its trade barriers had already cost the region an astonishing $272 billion. This estimate, proclaimed the Christian Aid website, came from work it had itself commissioned from an expert in econometrics, whose work had then been reviewed by a panel of academic experts. I was somewhat surprised by this, so I emailed Christian Aid, and they duly sent me the study and the composition of the expert panel. Christian Aid, I concluded, was being a little economical with the truth. Surely somewhat unfortunate in one of our most respected charities. The expert they had commissioned turned out to be a young man at the School of Oriental and African Studies, the only economics department in Britain that is solidly Marxist. He had, as far as I could tell from Google Scholar, never published an article on trade, but had previously written an unpublished paper denouncing international trade policies. However, I was reassured to see that his paper was issued by a group called CEPR, which I took as the acronym for the Center for Economic Policy Research, probably the most respected economics think tank in Britain. You have to be a fellow of the CEPR to issue one of their working papers, and they set high standards. But then I discovered that the CEPR that had issued his paper was not the internationally renowned London Group, but the Centre for Economic and Policy Research, a little outfit in the United States. I do not imagine for a moment that there was any deliberate misrepresentation involved. It just misled me. And, after all, there was the academic panel. Unfortunately, this turned out to be two gentlemen whom the author himself had chosen and who were not noted for their expertise on international trade. So here was the largest charity campaign in the United Kingdom, spending many thousands of pounds donated by Christians around the country, who had given their money to what they imagined was an organization that they could trust beyond question, and the campaign was based on this unpublished paper. I decided that it was time to subject this paper to proper scrutiny. As it happens, I did my doctorate on international trade. Though I would not claim to be one of the real experts, at least I know who they are. So I sent it to three of the world's leading experts on international trade: Jagdish Bhagwati, professor at Columbia University, Kofi Annan's trade advisor, and probably the greatest living expert on international trade, Tony Venables, whose work you have already come across in Chapter 6, and who is Professor of International Economics at the London School of Economics, and currently also Chief Economist at the Department for International Development, Britain's aid agency, and finally David Greenaway, a professor at the University of Nottingham, head of its Globalization Centre, and editor of the journal The World Economy. They all decided that the study was deeply misleading. In the end, we sent a joint letter to the Financial Times issuing a warning. I do not know whether this is simply an example of the headless heart. Trade policy is unusually difficult for people to understand, and Christian Aid may well not have done sufficient homework. It may instead be that its advocacy department had been infiltrated by Marxists, as briefly happened to the British Labour Party in the 1980s. The most depressing explanation I have heard came from an expert at the Department of Trade and Industry, who had better stay nameless. His account was, "They know it's crap, but it sells the T-shirts." As I write, it is too early to tell which situation it is: confused Christians, infiltrating Marxists, or corporate marketing executives, so you will need to consult the group's website and judge for yourself. Another government insider, who had also better remain anonymous, told me that the politicians were too scared of Christian Aid to dare to contradict it. Claire Short, a soon-to-retire Member of Parliament and a former Secretary of State for International Development, was the only one with the guts to take them on, he said, and she's gone. So, unlikely as it seems, it is the NGOs that now have power without responsibility. And that is because the general public is ignorant of trade policy, but trusts Christian Aid to get it right. The question, then, is what a responsible NGO should be campaigning for. Rich country trade policy is part of the problem. As everyone knows, there are some indefensible aspects of OECD trade policy. The least defensible, from the perspective of both OECD citizens and people in developing countries, is probably the protection of agriculture. We waste our own money subsidizing the production of crops that then close off opportunities for people who have few alternatives. When US and European Union trade negotiators jointly proposed that instead of the OECD lowering these production subsidies, poor countries might shift to other activities, I personally felt they had crossed the line beyond which the normal diplomatic act of lying for your country becomes too shaming to accept. The US South really does have alternatives to cotton. Its cotton growers live in the most bountiful economy on earth. But cotton growers in Chad? Another dysfunctional aspect of rich country trade policy is tariff escalation. The tariffs on processed materials are higher than on the unprocessed materials. This makes it harder for the countries of the bottom billion to diversify their exports by processing their raw materials before exporting them. It hurts us and impedes the development of countries that are already facing enough impediments. These are examples of policy incoherence, where one policy works against another. It is stupid to provide aid with the objective of promoting development and then adopt trade policies that impede that objective. The reason this happens is that trade policy is negotiated. The essence of the World Trade Organization and of its predecessor organization, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT, is that the reduction in our trade restrictions is something that we concede only in return for others doing likewise. The countries at the bottom played no part in GATT. Mostly they were not even members. But when the WTO was formed in 1995, they all joined, for being in this club meant belonging to the modern world. However, they have virtually no role in an organization that is designed for bargaining. The countries at the bottom have no markets of any interest to the rest of the world, and so their high trade restrictions are also of no interest. Bottom billion trade barriers are also part of the problem. What about trade protection on the part of the bottom billion themselves? Their own individual markets are tiny and stagnant, so focusing on the domestic market, which is all that protection can achieve, is going to get nowhere. Despite this, trade protection has been the ostensible strategy of bottom billion governments for 40 years, although its main motivation for protection was probably not strategic at all. The high tariffs induced a high cost. Parasitic industry that realized its profits depended upon lobbying rather than on productive efficiency. Globally, we now know what produces productivity growth in manufacturing. It is competition. Firms hate competition because it forces them into painful changes, and painful change is what generates productivity growth. Bottom billion firms have faced very little competition. They have been protected from external competition by trade barriers, and from internal competition because the domestic market is often too small to support more than one or two firms in an activity. The quiet life that bottom billion firms have enjoyed has been paid for by ordinary people, who have faced prices inflated above world levels by protection. That is what protection means. The quiet life has shown up in the rate of productivity growth. In bottom billion manufacturing, the rate has been around zero, in contrast to the global trend of rapid progress. Gradually, over the past two decades, governments have been coaxed and cajoled into reducing trade barriers. Inevitably, when exposed to external competition, these unviable activities curl up and die. I am not, however, an enthusiast for Big Bang trade liberalization. Where there is some hope that firms can become globally competitive, it may be better to draw their feet gradually closer to the fire than to push them into sudden death. Trade liberalization has got parasitic firms off the backs of ordinary people, but it has not enabled other activities to flourish. For that, governments need to change a whole range of policies that between them determine firms' costs. Why do the governments of the bottom billion typically adopt high trade barriers? Partly because they are one of the key sources of corruption. That's why political reformers such as Marc Ravalomanana in Madagascar, Emmanuel Tumusiime Mutebile in Uganda, and Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala in Nigeria all made trade liberalization a priority. The corruption generated by trade restrictions works on both grand and petty scales. On the grand scale, governments confer protection on the businesses owned by their friends and relations, or ones that pay for the privilege. At the petty level, actually running the system of protection day to day can be lucrative. Becoming a customs officer is about the best job you can possibly get in these countries. For example, in Madagascar, to become a customs officer, you have to go to the school that trains them. So getting into the school is a passport to prosperity. The bribe to get a place is 50 times the country's per capita annual income. That tells you all you need to know about the customs service in Madagascar. The vice president of Nigeria used to be a customs officer. He had talents and so was offered promotion, but he turned it down. One can imagine why. The enthusiasm of the villains for the opportunities for corruption that trade restrictions constitute, and the consequent struggle of reformers to reduce barriers, is misread by NGOs such as Christian Aid. Seeing everything through the spectrum of rich countries oppressing poor countries, these agencies spend charitable donations opposing the reduction in African trade barriers. Lenin had a phrase for those in the West who supported him without understanding his true intent: useful idiots. Today's useful idiots campaign for trade barriers. Aid worsens the problem of trade barriers. Although Christian Aid wants Africa to maintain high trade barriers, of course it also wants a big increase in aid. These two positions are disastrously incompatible. Extra aid needs to be accompanied by African trade liberalization, or it could even increase poverty. Aid can only be used for imports. I know this sounds a bit odd. Aid is supposed to be paying for schools and such like. But aid is foreign exchange. Dollars, pounds, euros. If governments choose to spend this aid on schools, they have to sell the foreign exchange to generate local currency. People buy the foreign exchange in order to pay for imports. So aid is valuable only to the extent that people want to buy imports. If imports are banned or have very high tariffs imposed on them, then the demand for foreign exchange will be low and the aid will not buy much schooling. It gets worse. Other than through aid, societies pay for imports through exports. Exporters earn foreign exchange and sell it to people who want to buy imports. So importers have the choice between getting their foreign exchange from exporters and getting it from aid. Put another way, aid is in competition with exporters. More aid means less need for exports, and so exporters earn less. The mechanism that generates this effect is the exchange rate. Aid appreciates the exchange rate, making a dollar earned by an exporter worth less in terms of local currency. Exporters get squeezed as a result, and some go out of business. This is the problem of Dutch disease once again. Dutch disease is rather worrying for aid enthusiasts. If a big increase in aid ruins export competitiveness, then inadvertently it accentuates the very problem that the bottom billion countries need to put right, making new export activities competitive. Fortunately, trade liberalization is one of the remedies for Dutch disease. Extra aid increases the supply of imports, and so a matching increase in the demand for imports is needed. Only with a matching increase in demand are exporters not disadvantaged by the extra aid. Trade liberalization increases the demand for imports by making them cheaper without the need to appreciate the exchange rate. The taxes imposed on imports are reduced. How much trade liberalization is needed? That depends on what the aid is used for. If the aid is used to buy foreign expertise, it directly increases the need for foreign exchange, as foreign experts are paid in dollars. But if the aid is used to pay for local school teachers, then it has little direct effect on the need for foreign exchange, as school teachers are paid in local currency and probably don't spend much of their salary on imports. So the sort of social uses that NGOs tend to favor generally require more trade liberalization than the growth-oriented uses such as expertise and infrastructure. Christian Aid should be campaigning for African trade liberalization alongside extra aid. I do not know whether the advocacy people in Christian Aid simply have not understood this connection between aid and trade policy. It is not Christian Aid's fault if trade liberalization doesn't sell t-shirts as well as depictions of capitalist pigs do, but profiting from popular misconceptions is their fault. What are the answers? Is fair trade the answer? The Fair Trade Campaign attempts to get higher prices for some of the bottom billion's current exports, such as coffee. The price premium in fair trade products is a form of charitable transfer, and there is evidently no harm in that. But the problem with it, as compared with just giving people the aid in other ways, is that it encourages recipients to stay doing what they are doing, producing coffee. A key economic problem for the bottom billion is that producers have not diversified out of a narrow range of primary commodities. Raising their prices, albeit infinitesimally, since fair trade is such a small component of demand, makes it harder for people to move into other activities. They get charity as long as they stay producing the crops that have locked them into poverty. Is regional integration the answer? For 40 years, the politically correct solution to bottom billion trade problems has been regional integration. The success of the European Community as an economic free trade area, technically a customs union, added political impetus to a strategy that was already attractive. Countries could keep high barriers against rich countries, but remove them against each other. There are so many fallacies in this approach that it is a question of where to start. But the politics were indeed magical. So attractive were regional integration schemes that they proliferated. In fact, the world now has more regional trade schemes than countries, so some countries must be in many of them. The typical African country is in 4 arrangements, often incompatible ones. Why have they been so popular? Well, presidents could get in their jets, meet up with some of the neighbors, and sign a trade protocol. set up a regional secretariat to which they appointed their friends, and fly out again, having garnered lots of publicity. Such schemes have not accomplished much, however. One reason is that even in the best-case scenario, the resulting markets remain tiny. A famous statistic is that the whole of sub-Saharan Africa has an economy about the size of Belgium's. A second reason is that if you combine a number of poor, slow-growing individual economies, you have a poor, slow-growing regional economy. Trade is really generated by differences, and the big opportunity for low-income countries is to trade with rich countries, harnessing the advantage of their cheap labor. Within a group of poor countries, there simply are not sufficient differences to generate much trade. Worse, the differences that do exist between poor countries will get reinforced rather than reduced. The model of the European community is unfortunately deeply misleading. Recall that Europe's great success has been convergence. The poorer countries, such as Portugal and Ireland, have caught up with the richer countries. Free trade within Europe has been equalizing and will continue to be with the recent enlargement of the EU. Tony Venables discovered, on the other hand, that regional integration between poor countries generates divergence instead of convergence. The reason for this is that regional schemes, whether between rich countries or poor countries, benefit those member countries that have characteristics closest to the global average. In a rich country club, the member closest to the global average is the poorest member. In a poor country club, the member closest to the global average is the richest. So in the rich country clubs, the poorest member gains, convergence, while in the poor country clubs, the richest member gains, divergence. Why does a regional scheme benefit those countries closest to the global average? Think of the European Union. Its common external tariff keeps out labor-intensive goods from poor countries. This creates opportunities for the countries within the EU that have the cheapest labor, which are the poorest member countries. The middle, with relatively cheap labor, is protected from the very cheap labor extreme. Now think it through for a scheme among the bottom billion. The common external tariff keeps out skill-intensive goods from rich countries. This creates opportunities for those countries within the club that have the most skills, which are the richest members. The relatively skill-abundant middle is protected from the very skill-abundant extreme. Where regional trade schemes have been effective in the bottom billion, we see these forces for divergence at work. In West Africa, Burkina Faso lost market share to the local leaders, Senegal and Côte d'Ivoire. In East Africa, Uganda and Tanzania lost market share to local leader Kenya. Of course, the countries that lose out don't like it. In East Africa, the experiment of regional free trade ended with a complete closure of borders and an intra-regional war. More commonly, the arrangements never get implemented. For regional schemes among the bottom billion to make sense, the external tariff has to be low. A high external tariff implies that ordinary people in Tanzania and Burkina Faso are subsidizing inefficiently high-cost industry in Kenya and Senegal. These transfers are regressive and pointless. Only low external tariffs can keep them at manageable levels. Good access to neighboring markets is vital for landlocked countries without resources. Countries such as Burkina Faso and Uganda most surely need regional integration. But they should not have to pay for this market access by large transfers to richer neighbors. Uganda has good and plentiful agricultural land. It should be feeding Kenya. When the Kenyan government permits the imports, it does just that. But Uganda has no power over Kenya. Daniel Arap Moi, president of Kenya from 1978 to 2002, was famously in hock to local business interests. At one stage, some Kenyan businessmen took a speculative position on food grains, stocking warehouses in anticipation of higher prices. But because of imports from Uganda, prices didn't go up. The businessmen lobbied President Moi, and sure enough, he imposed a total ban on food imports from Uganda. So ordinary Kenyans had to pay more for their food, and ordinary Ugandans lost the chance to earn a living through exports. Only President Moi's business friends were happy. I expect they showed their gratitude. I met Moi just after he had taken this decision and challenged him on it. He told me that he had done it for the Kenyan poor, but one of his aides was sufficiently irritated by this answer to take me aside after the meeting and tell me the truth. So regional integration is a good idea, but not behind high external barriers. Part of the answer, export diversification. Manufacturing in the bottom billion is in decline. 30 years of protection created a parasite with stagnant productivity, and a decade of modest liberalization has merely reduced its size. How could manufacturing get on a productivity escalator? For over a decade, I have been part of a large network of scholars, Industrial Surveys of Africa, that has been studying African manufacturing. The group has been trying to discover what would make firms grow. We have looked, for example, at how firms cope with a high-risk environment, at why they invest so little, and at the effect of credit constraints. One of our most striking findings concerned exporting. African firms can and do export, but not many of them are involved. Those firms that are involved experience rapid growth of productivity. As usual with such a correlation, the problem is to sort out the direction of causality. Is it that the rare firms with rapid productivity growth are the ones able to export? In which case, so what? Or is it that exporting induces productivity growth? There have been similar studies for firms in the United States and for emerging market economies such as China, but ours is, I think, the only one for bottom billion economies. For firms in the United States, exporting has no effect on productivity growth. This is not surprising, since firms can learn as much from competing to sell products in Kansas as they can from selling them in France. The same turns out to be true of China. Evidently, the Chinese market is sufficiently large and competitive that companies have to keep getting more productive in order to survive. But Africa is a different story. There, exporting really does appear to raise productivity. Domestic markets are too small to support much competition, and so learning from exporting is differentially powerful. We found it was a big effect. Whereas the norm for African manufacturing was stagnant productivity, exporting got a firm on a productivity escalator. So if Africa, and by extension the other bottom billion economies, are to get a dynamic manufacturing sector, it is more likely to come from breaking into export markets than from going back to the years of cozy domestic monopolies. The problem is how to get firms over that initial hump of competitiveness and enable them to get on the escalator. How to get export diversification started. Protection from Asia. The bottom billion do need some helpful OECD trade policies, but they are not fair trade, nor could they be described as trade justice, and they certainly don't fit with Christian Aid's Marxist slogan. The bottom billion need to diversify their exports into labor-using manufacturers and services, the sort of things that Asia is already doing. Remember that this is the problem. Having broken into these markets, low-income Asia now has the huge advantage of established agglomerations where costs are lower than for those just starting up elsewhere. When Asia broke into these markets, it did not have to compete with established low-cost producers because it was the first on the block. For the bottom billion to break into these markets, they need temporary protection from Asia. What this means is that goods and services exported from the bottom billion to the rich world markets would pay lower tariffs than the same goods coming from Asia. However you package this, it is hard to get the word justice or fair into the frame. Privileging the bottom billion against low-income Asia is not just or fair. A more accurate word might be expedient. Without such a pump-priming strategy, the bottom billion are probably doomed to wait until Asia becomes rich and is at a substantial wage disadvantage against the bottom billion. Even with high Asian growth, it will take several decades to open up a wage gap that is wide enough to spur firms to relocate. Only around 16% of the cost of labor-intensive goods is, in fact, wages. So if bottom billion wages were 1/16 of Asia's, this would provide only a 15% cost advantage. You then set the meter ticking on other cost disadvantages, such as transport costs, law enforcement, corruption, electricity, and availability of skilled labor and business services. You soon get to 15%. Remember, the Asia-OECD wage gap grew very wide before Asia became competitive with the OECD. It is, of course, inconceivable that the OECD would impose new tariffs on Asia that protected the bottom billion in OECD markets, nor should they. Rather, they should remove tariffs against the bottom billion where they already have tariffs against Asia. One vital implication of this is that the strategy is urgent. World tariff levels are falling. The WTO is in the process of negotiating mutual tariff reductions between the successful developing countries, which clearly have a lot to bargain with, and the OECD. This is its core business, and over the next decade it will probably succeed. So by around 2015, OECD tariffs against Asia will not be high enough for there to be much scope for protecting the bottom billion. We must use this policy opportunity now because it will not be available later. However, the same feature that makes the strategy urgent also makes it both acceptable and potent. The policy is urgent because tariffs against Asia are temporary. This makes protection for the bottom billion much more acceptable for Asia. The policy will phase out. Indeed, it might be to Asia's advantage. Once OECD protectionist interests realize that their lobbying is helping the bottom billion rather than themselves, they will be less inclined to oppose the liberalization that Asia is so keen to see happen. Temporariness also increases potency. If governments in the bottom billion know that they have a window of opportunity of only a few years to break into OECD markets, they are more likely to make the complementary policy changes than if they thought the opportunity would always be there. Is temporary protection for the bottom billion against Asia in OECD markets politically infeasible? Definitely not. In fact, we are already doing it. The United States has a scheme called the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, which does just that. Products from Africa enter the U.S. market duty-free. The EU has a scheme called Everything But Arms, EBA, that is supposed to do the same for access to the European market. And in Singapore in December 2005, rich country governments from all the OECD countries committed to freer access for the least developed countries. If we are already doing it, why the fuss? Because these schemes don't work. This is not because they are a bad idea, but because the devil is in the details, and the details are wrong, probably deliberately. Such schemes were designed not to be effective, but to appease lobbies. AGOA got adopted because 60,000 African Americans sent letters to their congressional representatives supporting it. So what details matter? The first and foremost are the rules of origin, ROOs. In modern production, inputs are brought in from around the world and assembled, and the result is exported. ROOs are about those imported inputs, where they can be from, and how much value they can constitute relative to what is produced. ROOs are not arcane. If the economies of the bottom billion really could export anything to the rich countries free of import restrictions with no ROOs, then all China's exports to us would pass through bottom billion countries to have little labels added saying, Made in X. They would then come in duty-free. It would help China, and incidentally it would help us, but it wouldn't do much for the bottom billion. But at present we are at the other extreme. The ROOs are too restrictive. If a Ugandan fishing boat on Lake Victoria employs a Kenyan, the fish are not eligible for the EU scheme. The same problem was initially true of AGOA, but a special waiver was added. So even if a Kenyan garment manufacturer uses cheap Asian cloth, the garments can now be imported into the United States. As a result, AGOA has increased African apparel exports by over 50%, whereas EBA has been totally ineffective. ROOs can be fine-tuned to make preferential access either effective or useless. Another detail that matters is the timescale. AGOA grants the special waiver for only 1 year at a time, and AGOA itself is only guaranteed for 3 years. This is simply too short a period for firms to make investment decisions based on the market access that AGOA provides. For example, textile firms in Madagascar are now highly profitable exporting to the United States, but they don't expand because they do not know what is going to happen. A longer horizon would be a different matter. If aid is targeting the Millennium Development Goals for 2015, then so should trade policy. The EU scheme certainly doesn't suffer from a short horizon. In fact, it appears to be intended for eternity. But that is about how long it would take firms to understand the documentation. The scheme is massively complicated, and many firms are simply not bothering to use it. A final important detail is the countries that are included. EBA is confined to the least developed countries, so Somalia and Liberia are in, but Senegal, Ghana, and Kenya are excluded. AGOA is more inclusive. Confining the arrangements to the least developed superficially sounds well-focused, but is actually idiotic. Which African countries stand the better chance of breaking into the global markets for manufacturers, those like Somalia or those like Ghana? It's the headless heart again, well-meaning gestures rather than well-analyzed actions. What is needed is one simple scheme, the same scheme across the OECD, with more generous rules of origin, Pan-African coverage, and a 2015 phase-out. The details of the scheme need to be sufficiently flexible that they can be adjusted until it works. The intention should be to get the bottom billion into new export markets. The other part of the answer, rethinking the bottom billion in the WTO. What are the countries of the bottom billion doing in the WTO? It is the successor organization to the GATT, and its basis is reciprocal bargains. I open my market to you if you open your market to me. It is not an international organization in the same sense as, say, the World Bank, the IMF, or the United Nations Development Program. It does not have resources to disperse to countries, nor an objective that its staff must achieve with such resources. It is not a purposive organization, but rather a marketplace. The WTO Secretariat is there merely to set up the stalls each day, sweep the floor each evening, and regulate the opening hours. What happens is determined by the bargaining. This made some sense when the bargaining was between the United States and the European Union. Over the years, US-EU trade and manufacturers became virtually free of restrictions. The WTO brought in the emerging developing countries, India, Brazil, China, and Indonesia, which have a lot to offer both to each other and to rich countries in terms of reduced trade barriers. In return, they can negotiate better access to rich country markets. But the markets of the bottom billion are so tiny that even if their governments were prepared to reduce trade barriers, this would not confer any bargaining power on them. If the US government decides that the political gains from protecting cotton growers outweigh the political cost of making American taxpayers finance a hugely expensive farm bill, the offer of better access to the market in Chad is not going to make much difference. So far, the WTO has functioned badly. The present round of trade negotiations was termed a development round, but such labels really have no possibility of content in an organization designed for bargaining. You might as well label tomorrow's trading on eBay a development round. Trade negotiators are there to get the best deal for their own country, defined in terms of the least opening of the home market for the maximum opening of others. The countries of the bottom billion join the WTO, hoping to receive transfers in some shape or form, just as they do in the other international organizations such as the World Bank, the IMF, and the United Nations. But the WTO is simply not set up to do this. As long as it is merely a marketplace for bargaining, the bottom billion have no place in it. Their only possibility of power is to threaten the legitimacy of the whole organization. This they have already done, to the point of bringing the round to the brink of failure. The way out of this is for the WTO to add a transfer role to its bargaining role. By this, I do not mean a transfer of money. It would be absurd to turn the WTO into yet another aid agency, as there are too many already. By a transfer, I mean an unreciprocated reduction in trade barriers against the bottom billion. A gift, not a deal. I think that the Secretariat of the WTO should be charged with negotiating such a gift as the first phase of each round. The World Bank evolved in an analogous way. Originally, the World Bank was a mutual assistance organization, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, IBRD. It issued bonds on the New York market and lent them on at a small premium to countries that were sufficiently creditworthy. This was of no assistance to low-income countries, since they were too risky to be borrowers. So the bank added a new role, the International Development Association, IDA. Unlike IBRD, which has never cost rich countries a single cent, IDA is a transfer. Every 3 years, the Secretariat of the World Bank goes around to the governments of rich countries persuading them to put money into IDA. How much each gives depends upon how good each wants to look relative to the other contributors. The bank then distributes the funds. So the bank evolved by adding a transfer role targeted on low-income countries to what was originally a mutual assistance role for richer countries. That is what should happen to the WTO. The Secretariat could work on an unreciprocated trade offer, just as World Bank staff have learned how to run an IDA around. The essential step is to quantify the trade concessions offered by each rich country into a common unit, say expected additional bottom billion exports. Once concessions are quantified, they can be compared. Then the pressure starts. Why is Japan offering so little relative to Europe? Why is the United States offering no more this round than it did last round? That is the reality of how IDA has worked, and the WTO could do the same. Only once the transfer round was concluded would the bargaining round be permitted to start, and this would put pressure on the rich countries to make acceptable offers. But only once the bargaining round was concluded would the transfer round come into effect, and this would put pressure on the bottom billion to facilitate the bargaining process rather than wreck it. Further, if the bottom billion wanted more than they had received at the end of the transfer round, they would have to get it through bargaining. The two contrasting cultures of transfers and deals would not be confused, as is currently the problem. Part 5. The Struggle for the Bottom Billion. Chapter 11. An Agenda for Action. We have been through the costs that the countries of the bottom billion are inflicting on themselves, on each other, and on us. I have tried to put some numbers on the cost of a civil war and the cost of a failing state. They are big numbers. But really, it is not necessary to be that sophisticated. I have a little boy who is 6. I do not want him to grow up in a world with a vast running sore, a billion people stuck in desperate conditions alongside unprecedented prosperity. And stuck they will be. Clearly there are brave people within these societies who are struggling to achieve change. It is important to us that these people win their struggle. But the odds are currently stacked against them. We have been through the traps. Conflict, natural resources, being landlocked, bad governance. They have kept these countries stagnant for 40 years, and I do not see much reason for the next couple of decades to be very different. Will globalization improve the situation? We have been through what it is likely to do for the countries at the bottom. Trade is more likely to lock them into natural resource dependence than to open new opportunities, and the international mobility of capital and skilled workers is more likely to bleed them of their scanty capital and talent than to provide an engine of growth. If the world is like that in 2 decades, then, given my profession, my son is going to ask me what I did to avoid it. It has been easy for me to do something. I have written this. But do not think that just because your work is unconnected with development, you are off the hook. You are a citizen, and citizenship carries responsibilities. In the 1930s, the world sleepwalked into the avoidable catastrophe of World War II because electorates in the United States and Europe were too lazy to think beyond the populist recipes of isolationism and pacifism. These mistakes led to the slaughter of their children. It is the responsibility of all citizens to prevent us from sleepwalking into another avoidable catastrophe that our children would have to face. And avoidable it is. In this book we have discussed 4 instruments, aid, security, laws and charters, and trade. Each of these has some bite, yet at present we are using the first quite badly, and the 3 others scarcely at all. Why have the governments of rich countries been so incompetent? Electorates get what they deserve. Popular thinking on development is fogged by lazy images and controversies. Globalization will fix it, versus they need more protection. They need more money, versus aid feeds corruption. They need democracy, versus they're locked in ethnic hatreds. Go back to empire, versus respect their sovereignty. Support their armed struggles, versus prop up our allies. These polarizations are untenable, and I hope that you have picked up some sense of how quantitative research on these issues challenges them. It is now time to pull it all together. In part two, we went through the traps, and in part four, we went through the instruments. It is now time to relate the instruments to the traps. Not everything is appropriate everywhere. Trap by trap, what combination of instruments is likely to be most effective? The other key question concerns who is going to make all this happen. Since there is no world government, what is the realistic balance of actions between the rich countries and the bottom billion societies themselves? Which actions need to be done cooperatively, and how might that happen? Given that even within each group coordination is so difficult, what is the minimum that we can get away with, and how might it be achieved? What needs to happen? Let's revisit the traps and see how they can be broken by the instruments we now have. Breaking the conflict trap. The conflict trap has two points of intervention: post-conflict and deep prevention. Since around half of all civil wars are post-conflict relapses, and since these happen in only a few countries, getting a post-conflict intervention to work better is a good place to start. It is particularly pertinent at the moment because there have been a lot of recent peace settlements. Of the four instruments, I think that in post-conflict situations, we can more or less forget about trade. Afghanistan isn't going to export anything soon except drugs. Aid to post-conflict societies used to be too little too soon. That is already changing. Donors are learning that post-conflict situations take time to get better, and that aid is more usefully phased over a decade rather than dumped in a rush. The crushing needs of the early post-conflict period collide with government incapacity. One way around this is to deliver the key basic services through the independent service authority model. Competing organizations provide the services on the ground, while the authority finances and scrutinizes their performance. This would enable donors to coordinate pooling funds into the authority. They could, of course, coordinate through budget support, but many post-conflict governments are just too weak for this to be wise. It will also usually make sense for donors to fund traditional projects to restore infrastructure, but they will need exceptionally substantial supervision, both to ensure success and to guard against corruption. Security in post-conflict societies will normally require an external military presence for a long time. Both sending and recipient governments should expect this presence to last for around a decade and must commit to it. Much less than a decade, and domestic politicians are liable to play a waiting game rather than building the peace, and firms are likely to be wary of investing. Much more than a decade, and citizens are likely to get restive for foreign troops to leave the country. To be effective, an external presence requires troops with a mandate to fight to preserve the peace, as well as contributing governments willing to accept casualties. In return for this external security guarantee, the post-conflict government should be required to radically downsize its own army. It has to learn to rule by consent rather than oppression. While the military should be reduced in size, there is likely to be a need for an expanded police force to deal with a crime wave as the violent diversify from war to crime. In Chapter 9, I proposed a charter for post-conflict governance. International actors have had huge power in post-conflict situations and have usually been embarrassed to use it because of accusations of infringing upon sovereignty. The international community has so much at stake in these situations that it has to learn to be comfortable with infringing upon sovereignty. But it is far more acceptable for international actors to impose a previously defined international norm than to invent fresh demands on the hoof as a particular situation deteriorates. It is also far easier for international actors to coordinate around an agreed-upon norm than to try to forge an ad hoc coalition problem by problem. So in post-conflict situations, three of the four instruments are really important. Aid has already improved a lot. Military intervention is improving, or at least it was until Iraq, and charters are currently far behind. Therefore, the most pressing agenda is getting a charter promulgated. How about conflict prevention? Prevention requires all four instruments because it comes close to being synonymous with development. Recall that the deep risk factors are low income, slow growth, and dependence upon primary commodities. Thus, conflict prevention is really about breaking all of the other traps. Breaking the natural resource trap.